to order. We're short one person, but he's on his way, supposedly, Representative Jensen. And we have Representative Mitch Greenlick with us this afternoon. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2960. And Beth, if you can give us a brief overview, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2960 would require the Land Conservation and Development Commission to review and consider Forest Park for possible designation as an area of critical state concern.
Thank you. And Representative Greenlick is here, and I think would like to give some testimony from the podium, from the dais.
Madam Chair, thank you for allowing me to testify from here. It's a little easier to get out of these chairs than those. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, which includes the City Park, Forest Park, now. I'm here to talk about something that I hope will have consequences 100 years from now. We have Forest Park, and if you live in the metro area or have visited, my guess is you've been in the city park called Forest Park. At various times, a great place to hike. But Forest Park really has a greater meaning to us. You'll hear some testimony on it for those of us that live in the area. You know, when Lewis and Clark came down the river, they stopped at the Willamette River, and William Clark went up the river and visited Forest Park from the water, and he wrote in his diary a description of what the park looked like from the river with the huge trees. He was very, very impressed with it. About 100 years ago, the city fathers decided that they really needed to bring some folks in to talk about the future of Forest Park, and they brought the renowned park designers, the same brothers that designed Central Park, to look at Forest Park and to make some recommendations to the city. The consultants recommended that the city preserve this park for the future generations, and in fact, the park has been preserved in an important way for the last 100 years, so that the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of the city fathers in the turn of the 20th century now are able to use Forest Park in a way that's important. But Forest Park is really more than the 5,000 acres that is the city park, Forest Park, and the 70 miles of recreation trails, including the Wildwood Trail, which if you like trails, would be an extraordinary one to take a walk on. I think you'd find it quite amazing. Forest Park is really much bigger than that. The real Forest Park, as those of us know it, that live closest to it, includes the wildlife corridors from the coastal mountains into Forest Park, because Forest Park is a live, real park. In fact, Portland is one of two cities in the world that have a large mammal wildlife sanctuary inside the city. The other city is Nairobi, Kenya. So it shows how unique this kind of an opportunity is, but the wildlife corridors into Forest Park are very important. We have bear and cougar, and I had a couple of elk in my backyard eating my roses. Came out and looked out, and the elk were out there eating the roses. They looked up at me, I looked up at them, and I was glad to have them getting the rose hips off the bush that I hadn't gotten around to doing. But I mean, it's really quite exciting to be in an area that has the kind of wildlife that Forest Park has. We've had in the past, we've had a bear wandering around in the neighborhood many years ago. The bear was knocking over garbage cans and knocking on our windows, and finally got caught trying to climb an electronic fence into the zoo. Obviously, I assume there was either food or sex that was moving in that direction. That got taken back out to the coastal mountains. We have the summer and the winter range for the Roosevelt elk and the deer and the other animals of Forest Park, which gets me to think that Forest Park really is a much larger area than just the city park. And if we want to preserve it for our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren 100 years from now, we need to do something about it. One of the problems with Forest Park, with the greater Forest Park and the Balch Creek watershed that feeds it, is that there are multiple jurisdictions that have impact on it. The city of Portland is involved, does a great job at maintaining the city park itself. Multnomah County's involved, Metro's involved, Washington County's involved, although they don't always recognize they are. But all these jurisdictions are involved. So when we started to think about how can you plan for the future, how does Measure 37 play into it? What are the other factors that are going to influence the preservation of this extraordinary natural resource for the next 100 years? We thought of a variety of different ways. And one of the things that immediately came to mind was this notion of an area of special state concern. In fact, the first bill I had, which was in the 2003 legislature, simply designated Forest Park as an area of special state concern. That got a lot of problems from people in the city, people in the county, people in Metro, people in the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And we backed off it in this bill. And this bill suggests that the Department of Land Conservation and Development work with the other jurisdictions and consider what it means to create an area of special state concern. The fact is, that designation was put in the original land use bills in the mid-1970s, but has never been used. It was considered first for the Oregon coast, and the Oregon coast became a special goal in land use planning. It was considered for the Columbia Gorge, and the Columbia Gorge got its own kind of protection. It was considered for Smith Rock as a possibility of managing that as a resource, but it's never really been developed. So it really does make sense to consider this as one of the possible ways to coordinate the planning effort for the future of Greater Forest Park. You'll hear some testimony. I think we may get some fiscals relating to it, but I think we basically don't have any basic opposition to it, and I really thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions for the representative before we hear witnesses? Okay. All right, thank you. So we will call up Gail Snyder from Friends of Forest Park and Jerry Grosnickel from FPNA, which is the Neighborhood Association from Multnomah County, I think. Forest Park Neighborhood Association, that's what it stands for. And actually, why don't we call up all three and Jim Emerson? So you're the only one signed up? Thank you for coming here today. And just for the record, can you state your name and your affiliation or your address before you testify? You guys can draw straws on who wants to go.
I guess I drew the long straw. Chair Dingfelder, my name is Gerald Grosnickel. I go by Jerry. And I'm a board member of the Forest Park Neighborhood Association and a director of a neighborhood activist group called Outer Northwest Rural Advocates. And I support HB 2960. On March 20th, our board met to vote in support of Senate Bill 1011. And I didn't know at the time that this bill would be heard today. Otherwise, we would have gotten support for this bill as well. But Senate Bill 1011 would authorize Metro to designate rural reserves. And I believe that this bill would serve as an important backup to Senate Bill 1011, providing additional incentive for Metro to protect the rural character of wildlife habitat and watersheds of the western slopes of the Tualatin Mountains from urban development. Forest Park is on the eastern slopes of the Tualatin Mountains. And the health of the park's wildlife, both plant and animal, depends to a great extent on the park's connections and proximity to the habitat lands to the west and to the north. If the western slopes were subjected to urban development, Forest Park itself would become an isolated island, unable to sustain its own wildlife diversity. I have enclosed a map, it's on page 3 of the handout, entitled Ecoregions of Oregon. It can be found on the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife website, and it is an interagency effort prepared by EPA's National Health and Environmental Effects Research Laboratory in Corvallis. It is part of a national effort to identify the various characteristics of geology, vegetation, climate, soils, wildlife distribution, and hydrology that make for distinct ecosystems across the country. If you look at the Coast Range ecosystem, you will see a narrow finger at the north end extending southeast into the Willamette Valley ecoregion. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife specifically identifies this finger as the lands that include Forest Park. And they call it the largest forested urban park in the United States that provides important wildlife corridor between the Coast Range and the Willamette Valley ecoregions. Well, why is this relevant? It is the reason we have such abundant wildlife in our area and why we have elk in our neighborhood. This thin wedge into Portland proper connects the city to the Coast Range. It also provides a sense of place and a sense of connection to our wildlife, and partly that's what makes Portland what it is, a great place to live. I have included in the handout I gave you a letter that we wrote on behalf of the Forest Park Neighborhood Association to Metro. This letter is dated September 1st, 2006. We proposed that Metro exclude our area from further UGB expansions. The wildlife, the slopes, the headwaters, and stream corridors, the land use patterns, the roads, the connection to the coastal corridor, and the need to protect the park all argue for what we call a natural area reserve, and what House Bill 2960 might call an area of critical state concern, or what Senate Bill 1011 might call a rural reserve. However we refer to these lands, we believe they should be protected for the benefit of Portland, the region, the state, and especially for the wildlife, the plants and animals themselves. If Metro does designate these lands as rural reserves, it is my understanding that under the provisions of House Bill 2960, LCDC would then determine whether the lands were sufficiently protected. This is assuming, of course, that LCD finds the park, Forest Park area of influence is actually worth being designated an area of critical state concern. But it seems to me that this possibility adds an incentive to Metro to name these lands as rural reserves. We think they would like to, but we don't know. There's a lot of pressure to develop these hillsides for housing. There are tremendous views from these hills. Metro is actively seeking land in our neighborhood to purchase for their habitat values. It would seem to me logical that they would not then wish to degrade their habitat value by allowing urban development next door. I would like to thank Representative Greenlick for presenting House Bill 2960, and I urge you to approve this additional protection for the park.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Dingfelder, thank you for allowing us to be here in committee. Thank you to Representative Greenlick for being here and affording this opportunity. My name is Gail Snyder. I'm the Executive Director of Friends of Forest Park. The address is 2366 Northwest Thurman, Portland, Oregon, 97210. I want to hearken back to what Representative Greenlick was saying and just capture or repeat three of his words that I think we can all relate to: food or sex. Well, actually, there were some other words I wanted to. Oh, there were some other words that you said that I think are really significant here. When
everyone
I think about,
ears just perked up when you said that.
Okay, good. So, mission accomplished. When I think about Forest Park, I keep coming back to the thought that we stand on the shoulders of giants. you mentioned the Olmsted brothers. So many visionaries whom we have to thank for this incredible resource. Mitch, you mentioned Central Park. Personally, I believe that Forest Park should have the same stature as Central Park or Golden Gate Park. When you hear those park names, you don't go, Golden Gate Park, ooh, where is that? And I think Forest Park is such a remarkable resource for the city of Portland and the whole metro region that it deserves that stature. So I see this bill as a very visionary bill. We appreciate it. It recognizes what the metro region has in Forest Park, which I think we have historically failed to recognize. Forest Park is a remarkable legacy for us all. It's crucial to the region. It's to the region's quality of life, its sustainability. Forest Park is part of the economic driver for the metro region. There are businesses, ESCO, for example, which is a major business in the Portland area. When I talked to their staff, they told me Forest Park is one of the things that enables them to attract talented employees. Other businesses factor in quality of life, including Forest Park, in choosing to relocate to the Portland area. And Keen Footwear is an example of one of the more recent businesses that has moved here in large part for quality of life reasons. There are other benefits to the community that the park brings. They are not quantified, but they are quantifiable, and they are very real. There are their environmental benefits. The park is it's 5,000 acres. It's huge. It's an air and water purifier. We already talked about the benefits to business. And then there are the physical benefits. And when a time when we're concerned about the health of our children, here's this park with just unlimited opportunities. There's the emotional and societal health benefits. So it's an enormous asset. We need to steward the greater Forest Park ecosystem because, as Jerry said, the park is dependent upon the whole surrounding area, the bordering lands, that are vital wildlife corridors, vital habitat, and that rural lifestyle also, which is part of Portland's attraction, that its quality of life. The state legislature has the opportunity to continue a remarkable legacy, to be visionary and forward-thinking, to provide additional shoulders for future legislators and future generations to stand on. So we are interested in seeing the bill move forward. We do have some concerns about it, but we would like to see the bill move forward so that we have an opportunity to work with Representative Greenlick and have future protection for this incredible forest park.
Thank you, Dale.
My name is Jim Emerson, 13900 Northwest Old Germantown Road. I'm the president of the Forest Park Neighborhood Association. And Chair Dingfelder and committee, I thank you for the opportunity to come here today with colleagues and speak with you on this issue. And again, thank you to Representative Greenlick for bringing this bill to this point. I don't consider myself to be politically savvy, so I'm going to boil down what I have to say into basically three short stories, a past, present, and future. The past story has to do with when I was working for a Fortune 500 company on their technical evaluation team for site expansions at various sites around the state. And you know, on that team, we had to amass a tremendous amount of technical data. Everything from soils, power supply, labor issues, costs of materials and labor in different areas. And there were other people working on the kinds of incentives that different counties and cities were thinking of providing. But what was fascinating, when it all boiled out, was to hear the discussion at the executive level and the factors that made the decisions as to where this company bought land and expanded. And they came down to human factors surrounding quality of life. Two basic questions. For the executives, where would I want to live if I was assigned to head up this enterprise? And on behalf of employees, where would I find employees who not only were motivated by the company goals, but basically people who are happy in their community, and it'll create a stable workforce. Those things were both directly tied to recreation, quality of the air, quality of the water, and lack of crowding. Not every company is going to go through the same thing, but that made a powerful impression on me. So that's the old story, and that's a link between This bill's endeavor to protect Forest Park and the areas around it and the economic health of the Portland metro region, and through that, because of the primacy of that region and the state economy, the economy of the entire state. The second story is present, and it has to do with the quality of the area. If you haven't been to the area west of Forest Park, or even to Forest Park itself, it's remarkable the extent to which those two are linked. My colleagues have commented on that already. But, for example, Forest Park on the east slope of the Tualatin Mountain is very steep, and much of it is rocky, and almost all of the streams dry up in the summer completely. The streams on the west side are fed by springs that run year-round because of the type of soil and the fact that it's not as steep. Our property is only 6 acres where we live, and we have 3 streams on it. And that's where the animals come when they need water, and that's where they yard up in the summer and where they cruise around all year round. We're not only talking about sort of signature species like cougar and elk, which we've seen on our own property, but a lot of little unusual species, pileated woodpeckers, Pacific giant salamanders. We have 5 species of owl just on our 6 acres. And I could go on and on in that regard. The other species that uses both the west side and the park side are the hominid bipeds that cruise by on bicycles and run up and down the road and go hiking, set up easels and paint scenery, bring their kids out to cider squeezes and to the community-supported agriculture farm that's on the next road over, ride horses at the 3 stables that are practically within spitting distance, and all those kinds of things. These are really valuable attributes to have close to an urban area where people don't have to get in the car and drive 75 miles to some signature attraction like Mount Hood in order to have some quality recreation. It's right there in the metro region, and it's so important to preserve that. The third story is a hoped-for story having to do with the future. Mitch actually referred to 100 years out. I was just thinking even 20 years out. 20 years from now, hopefully most of us will still be here, maybe in a little bit different capacity, watching all of the Portland area's growth unfold. The state will probably have 5.5 million people. The metro area will be closing in on 3 million. And if an area such as the Forest Park environs is allowed to be degraded by urban development, not that urban development per se is bad, but misplaced urban development is very degrading, then it will be lost forever. And we like to think that this area will be available as both an ecological service and a human benefit to the residents of the area over the long haul, and that 20 or 100 years from now, people will look back at this bill and others like it, such as Senate 1011, and will be very happy that people like you had the foresight to pass those. So thank you in advance for that foresight.
Thank you.
This opportunity.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming. Before you get up, I want to see if there's any questions from the panel. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I open this up to all of you. Yeah, and I apologize for not knowing this, but I guess I'm still unclear as to what a critical state, an area of critical state concern means. What is that?
I'll be
what does it entail?
Okay. It's not known what that means.
Okay.
Those words were put in the original land use laws, and they've been tested, but no area has ever been named an area of critical state concern.
Okay.
It does give DLCD some ability to coordinate the planning for those areas, but the fact is that's what this bill is about, to explore what it really means and whether this is a logical use for that term.
One last question,
sure.
If I could. Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I don't know the answer on this, but are there any potential Measure 38 concerns related to this legislation?
37. That's the next one that we hope we won't see.
37, sorry.
There are huge concerns in terms of future. As you know, Measure 37, we think about it dealing with the past and dealing with taking care of those issues in the past. I think we'll do that, but in the future, any land use decision may have a Measure 37 claim attached to it, may trigger Measure 37 claims.
Thank you.
Representative Beyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My ears perked up when I did hear the phrase that they have a few concerns about this bill, but want it to move forward. I guess I would be interested to know what concerns maybe you do have out there.
Actually, Representative Smith touched on them, that we are concerned about what the meaning of area of critical state concern is. It is unprecedented. And so our concern is what other special interests might come to bear and what potential unintended consequences there might be. So if this bill were to move forward, those are the conversations that we would like to have in a great more depth. So.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to just follow up on that briefly. It would be interesting to know from perhaps Representative Green, like your reading of the statute or anyone at the witness table as well, what might have been the intent in the original land use law of creating the possibility for areas of critical state concern. And perhaps if we go further with this, we can hear from DLCD or a Thousand Friends or others who have spent a lot of time in the land use statutes to help shed some light on what this might have been meant to mean.
Incidentally, Thousand Friends, I think, are neutral on this. DLCD, I think, is neutral on this, although they're likely to be a fiscal that may come from Metro and the city and Multnomah County, I think, are all neutral on this. They were all neutral on the same bill last year, and the ones I've talked to are still neutral on it. I mean, it's interesting to think of the places that were considered for possible designation and dealt with in other ways. The coast, the Columbia Gorge, Smith Rock, were all places that literally are special and have a statewide meaning. I mean, I think ultimately you could imagine a state park as a part of this whole process. But I think somebody just wrote that, you know, as we do. Wrote that into some legislation somewhere, and it's been now 30 plus years since that time, and we've never figured out what it meant.
And I also plan to bring the department up, so maybe they can try to answer that as well.
We got folks back here for the next bill that can talk about this.
Yeah, as well. Any other questions for this panel? Yeah.
Just very quickly, Madam Chair, more of a comment. I know we're in a public hearing. I've always had a policy in my four terms in the legislature to support members of the legislature when issues relating to the district arise, and out of complete respect for Representative Greenlicht and adhering to that, should this go to a work session, Representative, I'd give you an aye vote.
Thank you.
Thank you
for coming today and testifying. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I actually will ask the department to come up. Even though it's the commission, not the department that reviews and considers. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I didn't really bring any prepared remarks today. We worked with Representative Greenlicht last session on a bill and arrived at a version that we were neutral on, and this is that version. So we are, as he indicated, completely neutral on this. There is a fiscal to this, and it's sort of an open-ended fiscal, and we did our best to try and find out what those costs were, and we have been in communication with Metro, and they sent us some email last Friday that we've reflected in our fiscal. But there may be other local governments that have costs, and I don't know what those might be and whether they've also turned those in. So really, if those issues are resolved, we would move forward with the work required on this. Representative Green is correct. We've never used this provision of statute. I know there was discussion in the past on a variety of things, whether it was the coast, the gorge, or Smith Rocks. During my tenure, but I understand that those things were raised as possible areas of critical state concern. But at this point, we don't know what it means. I think it's open-ended for the commission to decide to bring to the legislature, as this bill has written, something that we would ask you to designate as an area of critical state concern, and up to now LCDC hasn't seen fit to do that. We don't know for sure whether they would do that in this case. That this the bill simply asks us to study that. We don't have any preconceptions about whether this would or wouldn't qualify.
Okay, thank you. A question I had, and this is to follow up from Representative Cannon's question, have you looked or listened to the legislative record? You know, it's 30-something years ago, but to see what the original intent of this designation was. So I'm curious what the... Actually, it was Greg McPherson's father, so maybe we should have Greg and the original co-sponsors of the bill, what the intent was.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I did not study the record. Last session, I recall that I did some asking of some of our staff, and Ron Ebers here, who
has he been around that long?
Been around, but, and he's our resident historian. But I haven't studied the actual written legislative record at the time of Senate Bill 100 to see if there was any words in there that would give light to this. I apologize. We can do that and give you.
I think that would be helpful. The other question I had: would this entail any rulemaking on the part of the department?
Madam Chair, I don't.
I read the bill. I don't. See
I don't.
That
we
in here.
We don't believe any rulemaking is required. What we have to do is we do have to have public hearings and do a lot of coordination and studies, and most of that done in consultation with our local government partners, and then prepare something that we bring to the legislature as a recommendation, and then. After, if the legislature sees fit next session to then accept that and go forward, that could entail rulemaking and probably would entail something to protect the area if it was a recommendation to protect it.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for the department? All right. Thank you, Bob. And with that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2960, and I'm going to open up. I guess we have it listed for a work session and hearing, but I was just going to open up a work session.
Work session. That's just work session.
Okay, so I'm going to... Oh, we need to... Well, actually, no, this is your bill. It's not Representative Holby's. So Representative Greenlick is here for the second bill, House Bill 2723. I'm going to open up a work session. And Beth, if you can tell us about the amendments to that bill. We already had a public hearing on this.
Madam Chair, I believe Ron Eber was going to go over the amendment.
Okay, can somebody see if Ron Eber is out in the hall,
please?
He was
here earlier.
I know. He heard our name and he ran out, I think.
I don't blame him.
Heard his name and ran out.
May I just comment on this?
Yes, if you would like to represent Mitchell Greenlick.
This started as a very simple bill to give local authorities the ability to make lots legal that were illegal under certain circumstances. And in that discussion of the bill, a work group sort of naturally formed that include DLCB, the realtors, a variety of other people, and said, let's stop allowing any more illegal, a stop situation where people end up buying illegal lots. So they worked very hard with Tom Powers, my LA, and Harlan Levy and Ron, and created a set of amendments that we think almost exactly gets there. There may still be a glitch or two, but they'll tell you more about it.
Okay. Thank you. Ron, if you can, we have the dash ones and the dash twos in front of us, so if you can walk us through those. I'm not sure if the dash two replaces the dash ones or the two separate amendments.
It does. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Eber, Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the department. We're talking about the Dash 2 amendments, and as Representative Greenlick pointed out, there's been a group of city and county planners, the Planners Association, AOC, LOC, Thousand Friends, county surveyors, and realtors that have been working on trying to come up and deal with an issue that has bedeviled us for some 25 or 30 years. Since the requirements to partition land have been in effect. And this bill tries to address those issues. And with the exception of a few technical amendments and one substantive issue, I think we have gotten consensus. And if it's the committee's pleasure, I can walk you through these amendments in general. Section 2 of the bill is essentially, for the first time, a grant of authority, clearly to cities and counties, that they may, what we say, validate a unit of land that was not created lawfully.
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. And perhaps the rest of the committee may have this question. How would a lot be created unlawfully?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith. What normally happens in a county situation is someone's got 50 acres. They might have a field off to the side and a tax lot. They simply go get it surveyed and file a deed for it. And yet, in today's world, it would have to get county approval and be partitioned. And since it's already less than the minimum lot size of 80 acres, if we're talking about a farm or forest land, it's therefore an unlawful unit of land. But somebody may buy it, and three owners later, someone shows up at the county and says, I got this 50 acres or 20 acres, what can I do with it? And the county says, well, you can't do anything with it because it's not a lawful unit of land. It's not eligible for development.
Just one follow-up question.
Follow-up.
One of those prospective owners do a title search and discover that?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith, it would not show up in a title search. And that has been the problem. And this bill is trying to deal both with validating these unlawful units in some circumstances as a retroactive correction to deal with some of these problems. And it has some provisions in it that I'll explain that try and cut this off in a prospective manner.
So one last question on this.
Follow up.
So there's prospectively people out there who own real estate, who have done title searches, who have title insurance, but the lot is illegal.
That's correct, Representative.
And that's what this bill is trying to address.
Madam Chair, if I can follow.
Yeah.
You can create a tax lot without creating a legal lot.
Right.
So I have 160 acres, and I have four kids, and I say they're going to get this. I want to divide it up so they each are paying their share of the taxes. I just create four tax lots. And tax lots have nothing to do with legal lots. But they're in the record as tax lots at that point. One of the kids might decide to sell one of those tax lots. But it was never subdivided. The land was never divided to create it. This started in the last session. We had people exactly with this problem who came in from Multnomah County, lived in a house. There had been a building permit on the house. They came in for a building permit to put a garage in or something. And the county said, oh, you're not legal, even though they had given them a building permit at one time because they had never searched it. So they had a house on an illegal lot with title insurance on the lot and on the house, and we're told the lot's not legal. It's crazy. It's a really nutty situation.
Seems really irrational.
And the counties believe they did not have the authority to go in with an ordinance and make that a legal lot. That was the original purpose. It was simply to give them the authority, if they wanted to make an illegal lot legal.
Just the repercussions of that are tremendous statewide.
Yes.
That's the testimony that we had, actually, yes, from the public hearing. Why don't you go ahead, Ron?
Yes,
so you're on
Chair.
Section 2.
So Section 2 and Sub 1 is that grant of authority, and it says that the counties may validate those units of land where they were not lawfully established, and they could have complied with the applicable criteria at the point they were unlawfully established. So in the past, there were smaller minimum lot sizes or there were discretionary standards, and sometimes it was willful, but a lot of times it was just as regulations began to, and the requirement for partitioning took effect, particularly in the rural areas, people just continued with their normal practice of creating a tax lot or selling some land and not getting it lawfully approved. Subsection 2 of Section 2 is what I call the oops provision. Representative Greenleaf referred to it. This would deal with a situation where there was an unlawful unit of land and the city or county at some point gave someone a permit. And they exercised due diligence. They went in. They got approval. And then at some point they come back or another owner comes back and wants to bring it up to code. And the county says, oops, we made a mistake. That's not a lawful unit of land. We won't issue you any more permits until you get it fixed. And they're in a position where they can't get it fixed. So this would allow the city or county and would actually allow them to validate that unit of land if they've already made a mistake. There's consequences to those actions. Subsection 3 is similar and deals in some degree with the situation you heard at the hearing from Mr. Archambault in Jackson County. Someone buys some ground. It's already got a structure on it. They don't know it's an unlawful unit of land, and then they simply go into the county or city, and they want to get a permit to bring it up to code as a nonconforming use or extend electrical service or whatever, and the jurisdiction says you've got to get the parcel validated, which they can't do, or we won't give you any permits. And this is directed to give them the authority to issue those kind of permits to continue the use, irrespective of the fact the unit of land was not lawfully created. Subsection 4 makes it clear that such approvals for these validations would be a land use decision or a permit under state statute. Subsection 5 is to make it clear that the date of creation is the point that this validation occurs, so that there are a number of places in state law where the actual ability to build is dependent on the date of creation somewhere back in time, so that there's no benefit to the prior illegal activity. We simply say that, all right, we validate them now for things that happened in the past. Now you take the current date of creation and you're subject to whatever the current standards are at that or at the point you make an application. So that's subsection 4 or 5, and a requirement that some of the local governments wanted that then that unit of land, that validation, ought to be platted so we get something officially in the record that makes it clear that this is now a lawful unit. Subsection 6 makes it clear that the validation is only for those units that were unlawfully created before January 1 of 2007. So this is a look back authority to the jurisdictions. We don't want someone coming in going, oh, now a local government has authority to approve these things. I'll do one today and come back in 6 months and get it validated. We're trying to clean up a problem and then look forward. And subsection 7 of section 2 simply makes it clear that at the time an application is filed under current law for one of these validated units, that's what's applicable. And we do need to clean up a little bit of the language in sub 7. Section 3 is the key provision we talked about last time. That's the prospective section that says that a county clerk may not record a deed or other instrument documenting a new lot or parcel on or after the effective date of this act, unless it's accompanied by either a subdivision or partition plat, which means it did get approval, or something signed by the planning department that, in fact, it was a lawfully established unit of land prior to the time there was planning and zoning, or through several other legal methods of a lot line adjustment or such. Section 4 takes a working definition currently in Chapter 215 and brings it over into ORS 92 and defines lawfully established unit of land, which really covers things that are approved by partition or subdivision plat, or those things that were created in time prior to the time there was planning and zoning.
Very quickly, Madam.
Representative, a question.
Thank you. On page 5, lines 28 and 29, well, starting with 27, if a person, and it's been amended, buys a unit of land that is not lawfully established unit of land, the person may bring an individual action against the seller. Mm-hmm. What if the seller didn't know? What if the seller's the third one down the line, did everything prudently, did title searches, went to the courthouse, looked at tax assessed appraisals? Seller would still be on the line for this?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's correct. Section 5, this is existing language that's in state law. Legis Council is doing some technical conformance amendments to use the same language that's in the rest of this.
So Section 4 is current statute.
Section 5 is ORS 92018. The only substantive change there is on line 30, where it's changing the may to shall, that the court may award reasonable attorney's fees, make it shall award attorney's fees to the prevailing party. And that addresses, to some extent, the situation of Mr. Archambault in Jackson County, where he had brought legal action. He had proved his case that, in fact, it was unlawfully created. But the jury decided he hadn't been harmed for some reason, and he still gained nothing. And this would allow someone who brings an action and is successful to at least recoup their costs. And then Section 7 is currently in state law in ORS 93040 are provisions that require certain statements to be on escrow and closing statements in real estate transactions. This would add some important language that would say that the unit of land being transferred is a lawfully established lot or parcel as defined in state law. This is to try and be instructive to people who are involved in these transactions to look carefully and avoid buying something that isn't actually lawful, and is to try and get the right words there. In the past, it's talked about, you know, find out if you can do something on your land, and people might ask that question, and a planner might say, oh, yeah, you're in a residential zone or you're in a farm zone, you can get a dwelling under certain circumstances, but they're not asking the right question, is this a lot or parcel? And then finally, on page 12, lines 2 and 3, there is a requirement in state law that a seller's disclosure statement in a real estate transaction include a form and a lot of questions and answers that the seller, to the best of their knowledge, puts forth information about the property for the information of the buyer. And we would add the same kind of language that's back in the escrow agreement that says, is the property being transferred a lawfully established unit of land? I think for the record, you'll hear this is the one substantive provision where the Realtors Association still feels strongly that they don't want anything added more to this statement. The rest of the groups and the department feel equally as strongly that it's appropriate at the earliest point in the process to get people focused on this. And from my own experience, I just finished up buying a house in a real estate transaction. And once you get past, you know, the view and the excitement of buying a new home, there's this incredible list of things you need to be aware of. And the real estate agent in that case took me through the seller's disclosure statement line by line. And any place there was a yes or there was an unknown, we had some questions and we went back to the seller's agent to get clarification. And from our standpoint, the earliest way to get people focused on this very important issue and avoid the problems that Representative Smith was pointing out, we feel, is by getting people asking this question in the seller's disclosure statement. They may know about it, they may not know about it, but at least it's an indication that they need to get an answer, both the seller and the buyer. They might know the answer yes, or if they don't, then the people involved in the transaction, whether it's the title companies or the real estate agent or the buyer or seller, can go out and find that information. And that's an important piece of information.
Mr. Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. How would they find that information?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith. The primary way would be to go to the local city or county planning department where they have records of plats or partitions, or they can determine fairly quickly if this unit of land was created by deed or land sale contract, let's say 50 years ago, before there was any planning and zoning. That definition that I pointed out earlier of what is a lawfully established unit of land makes it clear that that is a lawful parcel.
Just a quick follow-up, just so I'm clear on this, and a tax lot is not the same.
That's correct. By that definition and the existing definition in Chapter 215 says a unit of land created solely for the purposes of creating a tax account is not a lawful parcel. Lot or parcel under ORS 92 and in Chapter 215 have some very clear meanings. There are those units of land created by partition or subdivision or are created through a deed or land sale contract prior to the time there was any planning and zoning. And we've had those definitions on the books for a number of years, and they've worked effectively and allowed local officials to sort through that important issue.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Keep going.
So, Madam Chair, those are the amendments in the dash twos. There are a couple places where we think, for all the parties' benefit, we can fine-tune these a little bit, and would ask your indulgence to do that and come back on Wednesday with dash threes. And at that point, I think we will have everybody in agreement with, I think, the exception of Mr. Levy and his concern, and he can best articulate that to you.
Okay. Since this is the first that I heard that the dash twos were not quite there, then what we'll do, since we did not post it, is hold over this work session until Wednesday. Just I'm announcing this now, so for folks to know, it'll be on April 11th then, because this is the first that I had heard. We have some other folks here. I don't know if the realtors want to come up and say anything on these on the amendments, and then I guess we'll see the dash three. So you'll be working on that.
That's correct. I apologize. I thought I saw that it was listed and scheduled for Wednesday in my conversations.
Yeah, I don't think we did, but I'm just announcing that just in case.
Okay.
I don't have Wednesday scheduled here, but my understanding, I thought the amendments were ready today.
We worked real close, and in my conversations with Representative Greenlick and Tom Powers, we would walk you through it today, and if there were any other little issues, we could see what the committee thought, get those fixed, and be ready to go on Wednesday.
Sure. Okay. We're set. I guess we covered our bases and did post it, but that was the first I heard that these amendments, the dash two, still had some issues to work out. Any questions for Ron before I call up some of the other members who worked on this?
Thanks.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for walking us through this. I'm wondering whether you can give us today or perhaps on Wednesday a sense of how many parcels are out there that fall under this category, and what are we looking like? What does Oregon look like if we sort of say, okay, you're in the clear, are we going to see development springing up in places that we never expected it to, or is this really just isolated cases?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon, I can't give you a precise number. What I can tell you from my experience and the phone calls I get, these do pop up from time to time in cities and in counties, and they need to be addressed in specific situations. I think it's important to note that when you create a lot of parcel in Oregon, it's creating a unit of land that's transferable. It does not necessarily mean you can build on it. Now, in certain zones, rural residential zones and city zones, it's more likely than not that you could. In farm and forest zones, there are other separate standards. So this only deals with validating the unit of land. It doesn't necessarily or doesn't grant anyone different than the current standards the right to build a dwelling or other structure.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Okay,
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just dumbfounded by this issue. Just so I'm clear, an individual could have title insurance, and yet that's no guarantee that the lot is legal.
Chair Dinkrant, Representative Smith, that's correct. The title insurance looks back at the chain of title and looks at, you know, there was a deed that Jones bought and sold it to Smith, sold it to Eber, but it doesn't get at the issue of whether or not that unit of land that's being transferred was actually partitioned if it was so required. And in the transaction I just was involved in personally, you know, I made sure to call up the county and verify that it had been partitioned.
So just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair. And this isn't a question for you, but there's an area exposure for the state of Oregon who does real estate dealings all the time, takes real estate as collateral, and I can they do preliminary title searches, and I would care to contend they don't go beyond that point. And
this is the first. I do real estate lending all the time, and this is the first I've ever heard of this issue. And so I appreciate your wisdom on this.
It's been a problem, Representative. You know, Art Schlack, who I think couldn't make it today from the counties, has long experience. We have faced this issue for many, many years and have tried to find a way to resolve it in a comprehensive manner. And for whatever reason, the stars seem to align this session that we might be able to do it. But I think you're right. It baffles us that it's gone on this long or that it doesn't pop up. But, you know, whether it's the title people or the real estate people or the county recorders, no one has wanted to, you know, step up to the plate, and so there are buyers and sellers that end up in this horrible situation.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Ron? Okay, thank you, Mr. Eber. We'll see you back here on Wednesday then.
Absolutely.
And Harlan, do you want to come up since you were a member of the informal work group? And I don't know if there's anybody else that we're in work session currently, but if there's anyone else who participated in that work group that would like to come up and testify in the amendments.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I want to thank Mr. Eber because this is very close. This Dash 2 amendment is a very comprehensive attempt to address this problem, which, as he mentioned to you, has popped up just about every session since I've been doing this for the realtors. We still do have that one concern that he addressed on page 12, and I wanted to briefly explain what our concern is with that section. But I do want to put on the record that we support the rest of the bill. We think it is a good bill overall with this one minor exception. The seller's proper disclosure statement is required by state law. The seller is not required to provide one, though. The seller is entitled to not give a seller's proper disclosure in certain circumstances, and if they choose not to, then the buyer has the ability to rescind the offer up until the time of closing. So in the vast majority of residential real estate transactions in the state of Oregon, this disclosure statement is used, but it is not used in 100% of them. I wanted to make you aware of that. But the purpose of the seller's proper disclosure statement is for the seller to disclose what they know to be the physical condition of the property. You know, what do they know about the property? Does the roof leak? Does the plumbing work? Do the appliances work? Even the items that you do find here in the section that this bill would amend, in the title section, these are things that, you know, the seller is going to know about. What we've tried to avoid in the seller's proper disclosure are legal conclusions. And whether or not a lot is a lawfully established unit of land, that for all intents and purposes is a legal conclusion. That does not have to do with the physical condition of the house. And we worry about that, sticking that into a seller's proper disclosure statement. For example, a little old lady who's owned her home in Sellwood for the past 40 years is not going to know the answer to that question. So she's going to check unknown. Most sellers are going to end up checking unknown to that question, so I don't see what it gains us. The problem is it does ask for a seller to make a legal conclusion, and if they choose to check yes and they don't know that it's yes, they may have committed fraud in the transaction. So we see this particular question as being problematic and respectfully request that this committee take that section out of this bill, but we do support the rest of the bill. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know how you take it out. I mean, you need something in there to trigger the thought process of should I be asking this question? Because if you don't have that trigger in there, no ordinary citizen is going to know to ask that.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith, we believe that Section 7 is your trigger, and we support what Mr. Eber has done with Section 7, because what you're doing in that section is you are putting it into the earnest money agreement. So the buyer that submits the offer and then the seller that agrees to the offer, it's in the earnest money agreement that the buyer ought to be looking into this issue. It says they should be looking into several issues, and now we're telling the buyer that they should be aware that there are circumstances where just because it's a tax lot, it's not necessarily a legal lot. And it fits in there because we are telling the buyer they should look into, you know, ORS 197.352, which is measure 37. We're telling the buyer they ought to look into other land use regulations, such as exclusive farm use zoning. We're telling them they ought to look into right-to-farm statutes. It makes sense to tell the buyer at that point to also look into whether or not the lot is a lawfully created lot. So we think that Section 7 adequately addresses that.
And I don't mean to be argumentative on this, but
this is the time to do it.
Anytime you look at a deed of trust or an earnest agreement, those documents have print of about 0.6, and you know they're cramming in 13 pages on one legal sheet, and I'm not sure an average Oregonian. And again, I don't claim to be an expert, but I probably do 15 real estate transactions a year, and I had no clue about this. And I've read my deed of trust. I read my earnest sales agreement. And so I'm trying to figure out how to at least cue the average Oregonian to at least think about asking that question. And to me, it seems as if we're going to ask people to verify whether or not there's insulation in the ceiling, we ought to be at least going to ask them, is this property being transferred a lawfully established unit of land?
Yeah, and I have a follow-up to Representative Smith's question. Line 17 on page 12, are there any zoning violations or non-conforming uses? Well, it could be the same thing. I mean, somebody who's owned a property for 30 years might not know. So, I mean, I agree with Representative Smith. I don't really see, there's a lot of questions in here that you could say the same thing, that if somebody answered yes in good faith or no in good faith, thinking that, you know, there weren't any, and then it turned out, in case it was yes, it's going to be the same standard as some of these other questions. So I'm not quite following you there, Harlan, on this.
Well, Chair Dingfelder, there are questions in there that we would rather not see in there for a variety of reasons. Like I said, it's a good bill. I wanted to put on the record that we would support you removing this particular section, but it's not a fall on your sword issue for us. The rest of the bill is a very good bill.
So did you have any issues with any other part of this?
Chair Dingfelder, I didn't until Representative Smith asked the question about attorney's fees a few minutes ago to Mr. Eber, and he raised a good point that, frankly, I'd never thought about. If you have an innocent seller conveying a property to a buyer, mm-hmm. And then, you know, you're requiring the court to award attorney's fees. You know, we agreed to that, but I hadn't really thought it through, so maybe that might be another one that you might want to consider as a policy argument. But the rest of the bill is a very good bill.
Again, I'm just trying to think of myself in that situation, and there's parcels of property that I acquire and I sell, and I don't think it's fair, just as a matter of fairness, that I would be legally liable for the attorney fees when there was no malicious act on my behalf other than the fact I entered into something that I didn't know up until today to ask that question. And so I struggle with that, but on the other issue, I don't struggle with at all.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Smith, maybe a way for you to fix that would be to have some finding. The court would find that there was some degree of culpability before they would award the attorney's fees, you know, some kind of middle ground.
Okay, so you two are going to go off and work on this and come back on Wednesday, or I'm not hearing necessarily that there's still, I mean, this language, I personally don't see it's very different from the other requirements in here, the attorney fees.
Madam Chair, my struggle with that is if someone, as you were using the example, a little old lady goes to sell her home that she inherited, and she may not know to even ask that question, and she could be taken to court, and if found guilty, automatically she's going to be obligated to pick up those fees, and maybe that's how it works. I don't know. Representative McPherson could share with us, but to me that seems awfully awfully draconian of a position.
Okay.
For someone who didn't mean to do anything wrong.
Any other questions for Harlan? Any other attorneys want to weigh in? Okay. Anybody else would like to make a comment on this amendment?
Thank you.
I see Thousand Friends back there is coming up, and then we have Representative Holvey here, so I'm going to close this work session and open up another work session. Thank you, and for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dan Eisenbeis, Legislative Affairs Director for 1000 Friends of Oregon. I don't want to add anything in particular to this discussion except to say that this has been an issue for many, many years, and I believe that the compromise that's been put forth in these Dash 2 amendments is about as good as we're going to get in terms of striking a comprehensive solution to this issue that probably has had effects that reach far beyond what we saw in Mr. Archambault's case. There are probably many cases where people have felt frustration about our land use planning process because of issues related to illegal lots that really aren't a reflection of how the system works or is designed, but how the system has failed to catch fraudulent behavior in the past. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Okay, any questions? Those are friends. All right, thank you. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2723. We'll hear back on that on Wednesday. And I'm going to open up the work session on House Bill 2620. Jeff, if you can tell us about the amendments, please.
Madam Chair, I have a note again that in this case, Representative Holvey and Mike Graney.
Okay, you're off the hook again, Beth. Hey, Representative Holvey, if you'd like to come up, and Mike Graney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to talk to you about House Bill 2620, which I've sponsored, and specifically the Dash 3 amendments. As I have spoken to you before about this particular bill, I can perhaps answer some questions, but just to recap the bill briefly, is that this bill basically just requires that on public buildings, new construction, that they include 1.5% to be set aside of the total cost of the project to be set aside for solar electric systems and or solar thermal systems. And the Dash 3 amendment actually also adds in a use of solar passive systems as long as that system can be or achieves the reduction in energy usage of at least 20%. That was something that I talked to the League of Oregon Cities about. They wanted that sort of inclusion to also use passive solar as well. They also wanted another exemption for public safety buildings and emergency telecommunication buildings, but as I saw it being an exemption from the 1.5% rollover, I didn't include that in this amendment because everybody could come up and want yet another exemption for another building. And so a public agency can determine that it's not appropriate, basically, and not include it in any particular building that they choose to build. However, they do need to take the cost, the 1.5% of that particular building, that cost, and roll it into a future project. So it's pretty permissive in that it allows a public agency to pick a good building to put solar technology on, and the 1.5%, you know, amounts to $15,000 out of $1 million for public buildings. And so it it makes sense that you'd be able to roll up some of those 1.5% as you go along and find a good building to install solar electric systems or solar thermal systems or the type of passive systems that we've described. And I know there's going to be advocates up here that can talk you know, more specifics about the solar aspects of the building, including Mr. Greeny here beside me. But the real point of this bill was really to give a boost to the solar technology industry in this state and also to help our state move towards our renewable standards and to help our utilities meet those standards and
by government leading the way, setting the standard, so to speak. I think that's important to do. If we're going to make laws to achieve things, we should definitely do our part to do it as public bodies throughout this state. I know that some people see this as a mandate, and to some degree it is a mandate. It's a permissive mandate, but we are locking in the dollar amount that it be used at some point in the future. But the idea of this mandate is really to save the taxpayer money down the road to help integrate more diverse energy sources into our grid system. And maybe we won't have to rely on coal power, or we'll have a little more water available for other uses because we have solar integrated into our system. I think we have great opportunities in our state, and I hope the Department of Economic Development, are going to speak a little bit, because one of the whole points of my bill was really to attract a PV manufacturer as part of a spin-off of one of the clusters we have using silicon wafers, for example, and the amount of water we have available for this industry on the west side. Hopefully makes that an attractive piece for that kind of industry, and I believe Mr. Repine might be speaking to an industry that has indeed made a commitment to come to Oregon since we've heard this bill. So with that, I'm certainly open to any questions. I don't know if I really addressed all the particulars about the dash threes, other than it also allows this to be in concert with state's energy design statutes as well, with Mike Graney's office, the Department of Energy, and tried to work with him to make sure that this bill was compatible with their current statutes.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Holby. And also, I appreciate you coming here. I know you have a committee, so I don't know if you need to go back because you're chairing committee and take more testimony, or you're working.
Well, I certainly want to make sure I'm here to answer any questions somebody might have of me specifically.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Holby? Representative Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I didn't ask you this. It just dawned on me. When you talk about a 20% reduction on solar, I guess reassure me that this is a goal that's actually meetable. It seems pretty high.
It's a 20% reduction, or it's a 20% energy savings using passive solar. I think Mike Graney can speak more specifically to that. I think that's a requirement that they have right now for one of the credits for use of solar, and perhaps he can elaborate on that somewhat. I didn't just pull that out of the sky. I hope I didn't anyway.
Madam Chair, Representative Byer, Mike Graney from Department of Energy. Yes, the reason for the 20% on passive solar is passive solar is, in general, the most cost-effective of the different solar technologies. So the purpose of the bill being to encourage solar energy generally, and we do have a fledgling local solar market of solar developers in Oregon, is to encourage the other systems, active systems, both for electricity generation and also for other uses, space and hot water heating, but not to rely just exclusively on passive solar, which you could do without that restriction and probably meet the other requirements of the bill. I mean, passive solar is definitely beneficial, but we want to see other uses of solar energy as well.
State Representative Cannon has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that topic, perhaps it would be helpful to give us an example of a passive solar technique that would provide a 20% reduction in energy.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, in general, it would depend on the specific building. It's passive solar usually means designed into the building, features about the orientation of the building, for example, and then the amount of south-facing glass and the angles that's used, and then what the energy is used for that it comes into the building. So I think it would, on any given building, you could probably design that much savings in, but it would have to be something that's consciously designed in.
Is it fair to say that a reconstruction project, which is also subject to this bill if it passes, would have a harder time meeting the passive solar requirement, or would have a harder time meeting its requirement through passive solar, would be more likely to use a photovoltaic? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, in general, probably, but again, it would be very building specific.
Yeah. Any other questions for this panel? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And I'm actually going to close the work session because we did post this as a public hearing because there were some other folks who wanted to testify and couldn't testify last time. So I'm going to close the work session, open up the public hearing, and then I'll open up the work session again. So I'm going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 2620, and we have some folks to testify that couldn't make it last time. We have OECDD, Oregon Economic Community Development. Why don't you come up? Thank you, Mr. Repine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. What I wanted to do, Madam Chair and committee members, was just to add my support to House Bill 2620, and I'm probably at it for a different reason. As many of you are aware of recent announcements that we were able to acquire a national world company, Solar World, coming to the Hillsboro area here shortly. And their primary business is solar panels, one of the top five companies in the world. And I think we are kind of the tip of the iceberg relative to this industry. As all of you know or might be aware of, is the governor has taken a very aggressive position for the state of Oregon to try to find alternative resources for both the fuel economy and vehicles and energy practical use for heating and lighting our buildings. Even on this building, we have actually Solar World panels that are up above the center part of this building for heating for hot water purposes. When I saw the bill introduced, I was intrigued by it. I talked to Representative Holby about it because I thought through discussions I had with my business development officer who was working with Solar World that they would be interested and actually excited to hear that a state that they're moving to going to create lots of jobs, create a whole new anchor tenant for a whole new industry, I believe, for Oregon for the next years to come, to see that the state was trying to take a proactive position in this and try to position a message to the citizens to what we do and what we represent to others, that we're willing to take that same responsibility upon ourselves and to acquire and suggest that there would be certain applications that were solar sensitive and solar directed toward business applications in buildings for the state of Oregon and public buildings, I think, is that kind of signal for a company like that. My business development officer had some discussions with the representative from the company, and they said, if we were in town, we'd be happy to come and talk about how we are very excited about the fact that Oregon is considering that. They were here already before you did this. We believe, quite frankly, and I'm aware of a series of other recruitments that are going on right now with similar companies who are excited because Solar World's here and they're wanting to come here. So I think we are at the beginning of an interesting change of an industry climate that will be centered around this type of business applications and building techniques. And so having the state being a supporter and a believer in it, I think, is just a nice complement to what we try to do in trying to recruit new businesses to the landscape of Oregon's current businesses. And for those reasons, I think the bill is very appropriate.
Thank you for coming here today and sharing that with us. Are there any questions for the department? Representative Greg Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, the one issue I'm struggling with on this bill is I'm thinking of the small little rural communities that I represent. And if they were to receive public funding to do a major renovation, they would be held to this requirement. And what I'm struggling with is, what if after a few years of depreciation, the solar electric or solar thermal system needs maintenance? How do we get a maintenance officer to come to Spray, Oregon and take care of their system that we just mandated them to put in?
Madam Chair, committee members, Representative Smith, I think it's a fair question. I think that's a question that a lot of people have been asking over the last few years. As you create this newer technology applications, how do you create the service base that will service them? I've been around long enough to know that I did building construction, as you all, many of you know, for 30 years or thereabouts. And I can remember solar panels back when I was, you know, in the 70s when we were doing first looks at solar. There has been an amazing amount of changes in industry. The technology has changed. The trainability, the cross trainability for like products and components, I think, are more prevalent. I would say even in many of the rural portions of the state, you find some very sophisticated technicians that understand this, or if they did not understand, that could be taught very quickly to make adjustments. That's not to say that it would put you, small rural communities at a disadvantage, but at the same time, if the trends are that technology will change and direct this type of activity within all activities around the state of Oregon, whether it's commercial or residential, and I think a lot of this is driven by the residential marketplace too, we see a huge different adaptation and sensitivity for people who are in the single family arena who are interested in this type of adaptation to their houses. There are companies today in the state of Oregon who are building this as their centerpiece of what makes them that much better a builder in single-family homes than the competitor. And so when you get that kind of level of more activities, not at just the commercial level but at the residential level, you see the technology and the training, I think, follow right along. What would happen at the same time this bill would gear up? I don't know. I can't answer that. But I think over time you would find that the technicians all around Oregon would be able to adjust to the maintenance needs that these type of programs will offer to the communities.
So follow-up. I'm struggling with this because I want to support House Bill 2620. Yeah, I wish there was a way to exempt out the smallest communities, because I think of Fossil, Oregon, where the public works manager also runs the backhoe, fixes the electrical outlet, if the toilet plugs up, fixes the toilet. They don't have the financial resources to call a technician in. Their maintenance person is their technician. That's all the money they have. And you start thinking about a county like Wheeler County, where with the timber impact dollars that they're about to lose, they just don't have the financial resources to deal with managing a solar electric or solar thermal system. And so I'm trying to figure out how to help them while at the same time realizing you're not going to get a technician to come from Bend, Oregon to Halfway. You're not going to get a technician to come from the Dalles to Union, Oregon. And so I'm trying to figure out how, if we hold them to this high standard, how do we help them meet that high standard? And I guess I'm uneasy with that because I know the reality out there. I own a solar panel. I have a solar panel that heats a pool, and I know when I want someone to come out and fix it, I'm 9 weeks out, and I'm at the bottom of the list, and it's, oh yeah, if I'm coming around that way, and at the same time, I pay a premium. And so I'm trying to figure out how to help our smallest communities adhere to this, and I don't see that.
So, Representative, it's closer to Fossil.
Okay, any other questions for the department? Okay. Thank you. Next, I'd like to call up John Miller and Cliff Schrock. And if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, appreciate it. John, why don't you get started?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Miller. I'm the director of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, and I'm speaking in favor of 2620 and the -3 amendments. I think these are important for several reasons, or this HB 2620 is. It saves money over time, and it starts the building off on the right foot from the very beginning on addressing the most powerful force that it's going to face over its lifetime that's going to affect it, the energy it uses, and the occupants, and that's the sun. So it's important to get these things thought about and started right up front. It reduces the cost of implementing them, and it reduces the cost of the energy over time. I guess I would like to address a couple of the questions. As far as technicians and stuff working on these, we're talking about electricians and plumbers. So Representative Smith is correct. There is some training that will need to be done by some of these folks, but They are electricians and plumbers, so there's no special. There are specialty licenses out there that work specifically on solar alone, but journeyman plumbers and electricians work on these systems as well. So I guess I'll probably stop right there and.
Well, I'll wait, and then I think I have a question for either of you. So why don't you go ahead? Thank you.
Okay, my name is Cliff Schrock. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. I represent a very active electrical contractor in the state of Oregon, Inland Electric. I'm a member. We're members of OSEA, and we are a union shop and are members of the IBEW. We've installed dozens of residential and commercial solar electric systems in Oregon, mainly in the Portland area, in the last 4 years. The bill, including the three amendments, I think would benefit our environment, first of all, bring employment to the state, unique employment. A side benefit, of course, would be the visibility of solar to people in the state. The state's using solar on public buildings, and I think that would encourage more widespread use among industry and consumers. My message is very simple. We respectfully urge you to pass this bill, and I think the benefit long-term to the state, the effect on the environment, the effect upon the long-term operation and maintenance of buildings in terms of utility costs can be very significant. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming here today. I do have a question to follow up on Representative Smith's comment, and since you're a member of IBEW, and I don't know if you're an electrician yourself, but regarding, I mean, it would seem to me, my knowledge of solar panels and solar systems, that there would actually be less upkeep or, I mean, moving parts, you know, that you would have to worry about versus traditional heating systems or energy systems. So I guess if you have any, it would seem to me the long-term costs of maintenance may be lower than with traditional electrical systems. So if you have any, it's just my limited knowledge of how these systems work.
I think both of us have an answer to that. We did talk about this. First of all, passive solar will require virtually nothing, no maintenance of those. And with the plumbing and the electricians, both of those can be trained fairly quickly on the any type of maintenance that would be done on these. And the maintenance on solar electric systems is virtually nothing over time.
Yes, and I can... I'd like to also add our experience with 46 solar electric systems over the last 4 years or so is that we've literally had no failures. We've had a reset due to a lightning strike where we had to tell the customer, pull the disconnect switch and turn it on, and that brought it back to life. But they're incredibly trouble-free systems. We simply tell the homeowners to go out and wash them once a year and leave it at that.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Any other questions for this panel?
Madam Chair.
Representative Smith?
I appreciate the comments, but I'm just going to be really candid. Some of those comments are very naive where I live. Trying to get an IBEW electrician or plumber to come to Heppner, Oregon is darn near impossible. And if it were possible, the cost effectiveness of it is so irrational, you can't even make it work. Now, Heppner is only 50 miles from Hermiston. You get into communities like Mitchell, you get into communities like Spray, you get into communities like Dayville, and if they were to take CDBG dollars, Community Development Block Grant dollars, or Special Public Works dollars, and they were required to install a system, it's absolutely irrational to think that a union-paid electrician is going to even waste their time and come down to those communities. Second of all, I want to talk about the maintenance requirement. And I know this firsthand. Like I said, I have a solar panel. I heat water with it. Twice, it's been blown off my roof. Blown off. Now, why is that? Because we have wind. If you this body has taken advantage of the wind in my district and said, we want to put wind towers up. Well, that same wind is a blessing and a curse. And the notion that the climate over in eastern Oregon is such that the maintenance requirements will be negligible just isn't rational. That's just not accurate. And so I'm trying to figure out, again, how to assist while dealing with the reality of what we're talking about and knowing it's going to put a huge burden on the smallest and most remote communities. And so I just want to put that on the record.
Representative Smith, I think given that passive solar has been added to the bill, my sense is because you do have an abundance of sun on the east side, which unfortunately we don't have over here, as I'm much lamenting the past few weeks, I would imagine that probably smaller communities would look very seriously at passive solar as a way to meet this requirement. And that is my understanding is not a very expensive design necessarily to incorporate into new construction.
Chair, I could also say that most of our members in the solar industry, actually, we love having the union members there, but the vast majority are non-union members. So most of the members in the plumbing and the electrical are non-union electricians and plumbers that are spread all over the state of Oregon. And I do agree there can be maintenance on these systems. I assume if it blew off your roof, it's probably not a solar hot water. It's probably a pool heating system, or was it
a water panel?
Wow. And it must have had to have been replaced.
The wind in our area gets up of 80, 90 miles an hour, and when it rips off, you replace the whole system.
Right. Yeah. So there can be maintenance issues like that. That's not necessarily a maintenance issue. That's a failure issue on it. But again,
nature just doesn't get that.
That is a plumbers, non-union plumbers, and non-union electricians work on these systems as well.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. And last, we have a representative from Osperg, Jeremiah Bellman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeremiah Bauman with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, Osperg. Being sensitive to the time considerations, I'll keep this brief. Let me just talk quickly about why Osperg very strongly supports this bill, and then mostly focus on some of the changes that have been made and some of the concerns that have come up. There's obviously a lot of talk this session and certainly from this committee about the need for Oregon to become more renewable. Solar power is a unique angle on that renewability because it provides an additional benefit, several additional benefits. One is that it's statewide. All of Oregon has an excellent solar resource, better than the countries that have world leader status in solar power generation right now. But beyond that, you get more benefits than just that renewability, and I think there are benefits that are particularly important for local smaller communities, which is you have local generation of that renewable power, which gives you reliability. It eases the congestion on an overly burdened grid right now. It gives you energy conservation. A lot of electricity is lost in transmission over long distances. And it gives local communities a way to truly take control of their energy future. They're not only not dependent on out-of-state fossil fuels, they're not even dependent on wind from 100 miles away because they've got the resources right there in their towns and on their buildings. Let me just comment briefly on why this particular policy focus in terms of using public agencies, public institutions, and public buildings to push Oregon towards greater reliance on solar power. I think the first important reason is what Representative Holvey said, which is that it's important the government lead by example. Solar is a well-developed technology, but it's still more expensive than other renewable technologies, and so it's one that we still need to be spurring that marketplace. Secondly, solar is a technology that has a payback. It reduces your energy consumption from the grid, and so it pays for itself. The payback, however, is a pretty long period of time right now. Public institutions are owning those buildings for a very long period of time, and they're in the best position to take on a long payback period. It doesn't matter if it's 10, 15, 20, 25-year payback. Government agencies tend to be building buildings that are going to be lasting for that long, and they plan to own them for that long. Let me just close with a couple additional remarks. First, I think Representative Holvey has handled a lot of the concerns on this bill incredibly well with some very smart solutions. The 20% savings standard through passive solar is a very good solution to the dilemma of how to handle passive solar. As you've heard, passive solar basically can involve things as simple as orienting the building the right way, putting windows and eaves in the right place so the sun can naturally heat and cool the building without the requirement of a lot of energy-consuming heating and cooling devices. I often think of this as what we used to do 10,000 years ago before we got so smart we wanted to build complicated technology to heat and cool our homes. When we used to just make sure that you picked the cave that faced south. That, of course, leads you to the dilemma, which is it's hard to have a clear standard for the technology when it's mostly a matter of using common sense. The 20% energy savings makes it clear that we're getting a reliable savings from using that technology. The rollover requirement is also a good solution. Not every building is going to work for solar. This lets the same investment happen without micromanaging how local government chooses to use it. And in terms of the maintenance issues in smaller communities, I think the flexibility of allowing passive solar goes a long way toward solving that problem. The other thing, I think, honestly, is it's sort of a chicken and egg dilemma. To the extent there's not enough infrastructure to handle some of the maintenance issues, we have to start investing in the technology if the infrastructure is going to get there. So I think this will spur the first step towards a direction where we've got solar technicians in every community in Oregon, which is the place we should be trying to get. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Any questions before I release him from witness stand? Anybody else who would like to testify on House Bill 2620? Okay. With that, I would close the public hearing on House Bill 2620 and open the work session and entertain a motion.
Madam Chair.
2620.
I move the LC-3 amendments to House Bill 2620.
Okay. Representative Cannon moves the -3 amendments for House Bill 2620. Is there any discussion? Okay. Any objections? Okay. Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon.
I move House Bill 2620 as amended by the -3s to the floor with the due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay. Representative Cannon has made a motion to move House Bill 2620 to the floor with the due pass recommendation as amended with the -3s. Is there any discussion?
Very quickly.
Representative Smith.
This is a bill that I truly do want to support. Unfortunately, I don't think it's truly beneficial to rural eastern Oregon. As a matter of fact, I think it'd be detrimental to rural eastern Oregon, so I'll be casting a no vote. But I do appreciate the leadership and the hard work of everyone on this issue.
Okay, thank you. The clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Fire?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
He's excused.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Ingfeld?
Aye. So the motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I think we're going to ask Representative Holvey if he would like to carry this to the House floor. And with that, I will close the House Energy and Environment Committee, and we'll see you all on Wednesday.